Members, we're going to get started. I'm going to call the committee to order. We are at a quorum, and we haven't approved the minutes in quite a while. We're going to need four motions. Looks like we're going to need four motions to do the minutes. And I wonder if Representative Marquardt, you can get us rolling by moving to adopt the February 28th minutes.
Mr. Chair, I will move the February 28th minutes.
Thank you. Representative Marquardt moves adopting the minutes of February 28th. Any discussion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Yes, sir.
Would you be so kind to move the minutes of March 5th?
I would do so move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney moves adoption of the minutes of March 5th. Any discussion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Erickson Sanja, I'm wondering if you could do me the honor of moving the March 7th minutes.
Mr. Chair, I will move the minutes of March 7th.
Thank you. Representative Erickson Sandra moves adoption of the minutes of March 7th. Any discussion? If not, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And Representative Nornes, if you would similarly do me the honor of moving the March 8th minutes, I'd greatly appreciate it.
It's my privilege to honor and to move that.
Thank you. Representative Nornes moves adoption of the March 8th minutes. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, just to have the your committee at LA correct my the spelling of Erickson on the last page.
Oh.
I don't know if it's misspelled other places, but it pops out right there. But that's just a technical change.
On the last page. Oh.
Oh. I apologize.
I forgive you.
So the minutes are amended to reflect the correct spelling of Representative Erickson's name. There's no line here, but on the last page. All in favor of the amended motion to adopt the minutes, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. All right, members, so we've got several bills before us, and I'm not going to do this order that's in front of you. What I want to do is start with the department policy bill, which is House File 1151. I may be accommodating Representative Seltzer and Abler since they're not on the committee if they come in at some point. So just sort of a heads up. Everyone else who has the bill before us is on the committee. So with that, I'm going to move adoption of the House File, I'm going to move the House File 1151 be recommended to pass. The bill is before us, and I'm going to ask the Department of Education representatives to come forward and walk us through their policy. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Darren Cordy. I work in the Government Relations Office at the Minnesota Department of Education, here to walk you through the agency policy and technical bill. I believe you have in your packets a summary. In the interest of time, I'll be working off the summary, but if you have specific questions about the language that's in the bill, obviously be happy to answer those. And we do have staff here from the specific subject matter areas that could speak to the more in the weeds items, so to speak.
And members, please feel free to interject with questions at any time. It's a big bill, so I think it's certainly appropriate for us to stop at whatever point to ask a question of the department. Mr. Cordy.
Mr. Chair, members, starting with Article 1, Section 1. Section 1 is a change that would require school calendars to include at least 165 days of instruction. You may recall a couple of years ago there was only a days requirement in law, but not an hours requirement. That days requirement was removed in favor of a minimum hours requirement. And what we at the department found was that this was resulting in schools that were minimizing the length of their school day because they were meeting the minimum hours requirements, but it was changing drastically the school schedule, which would normally be something that would have to go through the flexible learning year approval process. So what this does is says that you still have that minimum number of hours required, but also you have to meet for at least 165 days.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Maiorani. So, to the department, this is fewer days than that we had in statute when we repealed the number of days and moved to, well, not necessarily, but moved to hours, because it was premised on a certain number of days that a school district had in a certain year. So, you found that there were districts violating this day rule, or did it have more to do with teacher contracts, perhaps, or staff contracts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I'm trying to find the actual proposal here. What the proposal intends to do is just to stop school districts from significantly reducing the number of instructional days that they have while keeping the minimum hours without going through the flexible learning year program approval process.
Well, yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. But why?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, as we found when this change was made, that there were a number of districts that were significantly reducing the number of days that they were offering. Part of the flexible learning year approval process requires the district to do an application. It requires them to have a public hearing where they would get input from parents about how the new calendar would affect them and, you know, possible other implications that they would have with care for their children. So the purpose of this was to say, you know, you can't reduce that calendar year in a significant way without going through the flexible learning year process, which would include getting the public input that is required under statute now.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you. So, Mr. Corte, actually you're taking away local control then, because these districts probably are accomplishing what they need to do without using a flexible learning year, as long as they are meeting the requirements of instructional time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I think that, as I mentioned, the purpose isn't necessarily to get rid of local control. It's just saying that if you're going to go through the flexible learning year process, which, by the way, all districts that have applied for a flexible learning year process, and for the most part, unless they've had, if they have all their ducks in order, we do approve those. So it's not an extremely difficult hurdle for them to jump, but we do expect them, if they are going to be significantly altering their number of days offered, that they go through that learning year program that's currently outlined in the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one final comment. Well, when we changed this law, we did so based on the fact that we had districts, and I think it was a minimal number, but we did find districts who were not providing enough instruction in a day or in a school year, and that's why we converted to this, because we were concerned about the learning, not the time on task, but the learning that was going on and the opportunity to learn. So, I find this a little interesting, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. There are several questions, I believe, obviously, on this, because we're only on the first page. Representative Faust, and then Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. How many days were required before the change to 1,020 hours? And the flexible school year process is, I know a couple schools that have four-day weeks. So is that, they have to go through that process to be approved for four-day weeks? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Faust, that's correct. To your first question, I'm not sure off the top of my head, and maybe staff could take a look at the old books and see what the old requirement was. I don't have that in front of me. But to your second question, yes, if a school district is planning to go to a four-day week, they would have to go through the flexible learning year approval process.
Representative Faust, okay. Representative Narnas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, my question ahead has been answered. I have a school district that has a four-day week, and I believe they're in the second year or maybe third year of doing that. So my question was how this would affect it, but I see in the bill language it takes care of that. So,
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair, members, moving on to Article 1, Section 2. regarding post-secondary enrollment options, transportation. I believe that there's an amendment to this that you'll be addressing at some point, but basically the idea of this bill was something that was brought to us, or this proposal was brought to us by St. Paul, and they just wanted to be able to use Gen Ed funds to pay for PSEO programs. Currently that's prohibited in law, and we think that prohibition is probably a relic from when transportation dollars were outside of Gen Ed revenue. So this just says if a district wants to, they can use general fund dollars to pay for PSEO transportation.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to make sure that it cannot somehow be construed that they are forced to do it, does it?
Madam Mr. Chair, Cordy. No. Currently, the statutory language just says that you can do PSEO transportation, but only if it does not increase the district's expenditures for transportation, and this just strikes that language.
Representative, okay. Any other questions on that section? Otherwise, proceed.
Madam Chair, members, Article 1, Section 3 is an amendment to the operating capital uses. This updates the statute to have allowable uses of operating capital revenue to include computer hardware and software purchases, but it would prohibit such revenue from being used for recurring software licensing costs. Sections 4 through 7 of Article 1 all kind of go together. These sections clarify that charter school pupils are going to be subject to the truancy provisions of Chapter 260A. We already believe that they are subject to those provisions, but it's specifically including charter schools in the changes to 260A here makes that clarification. Moving on to Article 2 of the bill. The first five sections of Article 2 and Section 8 and Section 14 are all kind of interrelated. And what our goal here in this proposal was to clarify what the educational expectations of Minnesota students are. Basically, the proposal is to reorganize five of these interrelated statutes regarding state educational expectations. The purpose of this change was to reduce confusion that exists in current statute for teachers and parents, but the goal was not to change the legislative intent that currently exists in law. So I'll walk through those sections at this time. Section 1 creates a new definition section.
Mr. Cordy. Representative Crenshaw, did you have a question before he goes through?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Thank you.
All right.
And thank you. Just a quick question back on section line 3.12. Just a question, why not the annual licensing fees? With much of the software that's changing right now, they're moving to licensing fees. Are we holding our schools? Just a question.
Mr. Cordy.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Prisha, the purpose of this was just for operating capital for that specific fund. You could only use those dollars to buy hardware or initial purchase of software, just because that kind of falls more properly within the definition of operating capital. There are other funds that they could use to pay those recurring software licensing fees, but the purpose was just not to have this specific revenue stream available to make those payments.
Thank you.
All right. Sorry for interrupting you.
No, Madam Chair, that's just fine.
All right.
So we were on Article 2, Section 1. As I mentioned, this creates a new definition section for educational expectations. All of these definitions you see here for credits, benchmark, elective standard, required standard, and school site are existing definitions that are just moved into this section. The one definition that is new is in Subdivision 2, which is the definition of academic standard. Section 2 of that of Article 2 reorganizes this specific statute make it so graduation requirements are clearly summarized there in Subdivision 2. The language that you see stricken in Subdivision 1 is moved into subsequent sections. Section 3 strikes obsolete language related to prior year standards revision cycles that have already passed.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Corte, would you explain why we're deleting history, geography, economics, government, and citizenship When we do have specific standards addressing those, if and when we have new social study standards.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe the intent of deleting those sections was that the specific content areas that are listed out in social studies is a bit of an anomaly in the statutes, in that the rest of the standards don't list out those specific content areas. So while, yes, those areas would still definitely be taught and would still be in the standards, we just wouldn't refer to them specifically in the statute. And I do have Ms. Oney here, who is our Director of Standards, who could maybe speak a little bit more to that proposal if you'd like more information.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Corte, well, I think it would be better to expand each of those enumerated items to include what's covered. Common Core standards, which now are our language arts standards, do cover quite a few areas. And I think it's better for those who are using the statute book as their reference guide, and that's getting to be more and more, that they be able to see what language arts consists of, what mathematics, what science, even in physical education. So I think we're taking a step backward when we don't tell others who are referring to statute what language arts actually means, especially based on Common Core, what mathematics means, science as well. And then social studies, in my estimation, should stand as it is, because those are the areas.
Mr. Corte.
This is my comment.
Mr. Corte.
Madam Chair, members, I believe the only the real reason for not enumerating these in other areas is just that by enumerating, you inevitably leave out certain other things, and just want to make sure that the entire spectrum of the subject is being referred to, and not just, you know, specific content areas if you're leaving out other things on accident.
Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Corte, this comes under required academic standards, though, and when we read through the standards and the benchmarks, these areas are delineated. So I think if we're going to be aligning everything now in regard to our standards and our benchmarks, then we should be able to say in statute what that consists of.
Representative Erdahl, I said to this point or another
point? Am I ever off point?
Well, no, you, not when it's your own point, but I'm not sure whether. No, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And no, this is on point. I agree with the points that Representative Erickson is making. I'm concerned about, you know, vagueness here. I think being somewhat specific, although flexible, is important. How was social studies defined?
Mr. Corte, is this an appropriate time to ask Ms. Oney to come to the table?
Yes,
here?
I believe I'd like to phone a friend, Madam Chair.
All We all have those moments. So. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, Ms.
Thank
Oney.
You, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Beth Oney. I'm Director of Academic Standards and Instructional Effectiveness at the department. I believe the question was, how is social studies defined? For purposes of standards, it's defined as the four disciplines of history, geography, economics, and government and citizenship. And then history is broken down into world and U.S. history and state history. So in our state, it's defined as the delineation of content areas.
Okay. And Ms. Oney, would you give your point of view on the issue about the more general titles versus more specified lists, and what the argument might be for either point of view?
Well, to this point, Standards Committee and each of the content areas that you see listed there have not had their understanding expanded by the listing of content areas, because when they revise the standards in a subject, it generally includes those broad content areas. So, for example, when social studies standards are revised, people assume that they're going to be revising history standards. They assume it's going to cover economics, and they assume it's going to cover government and citizenship and geography. So it's not necessary to point out those areas. Another consideration is that sometimes one can't anticipate what areas need to be added. For example, in English Language Arts, the Minnesota Standards Committee reviewed the Common Core English Language Arts standards and found them to be deficit in media literacy. And so the Standards Committee recommended that if Minnesota adopted the Common Core standards, that if those became our standards, and they thought very highly of those standards in English Language Arts, they'd be even better with the addition of media literacy, even though media literacy was not defined here in this statute.
Madam Chair.
Observers.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Thank you. Well, Ms. Ani, you know, someone reading our statute book is not going to know that we adopted the Common Core, or we adopted those pieces of the Common Core that were missing from our good language arts standards. And I think by not delineating what makes up each of these, we're doing a disservice to the public. So that they don't know that now language arts in Minnesota does also consist of media literacy. Because the statutes are for everyone. They're not just for an elite group or a select group. They are for everyone. And that's why I make the comments that I do, just for the specificity of helping others to know what it is our academic standards consist of. Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Erickson bringing this issue forward. I'm not fully persuaded that we need to articulate all of them, but I am concerned with the deletion of the social studies. The three topic areas above all have state assessments, which help to drive then the curriculum as well as the standards, and social studies does not. And I would be concerned in an issue in an academic area that has seen a reduction in time allotted to it over the years, that if we eliminate the enumeration on 7.17 and 7.18, we may see further reduction in time allotted or reduction in topic areas covered. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gaffney. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, believe we were just finished up Section 2 there, moving on to Article 2, Section 3. This strikes obsolete language related to prior year standards revision cycles. And at the end of that section, on lines 8.7 to 8.9, there's some language that's stricken, but that is moved over into Section 4, Subdivision 2.
And Mr. Corte, we have a question from Representative Erdahl.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just wanted to back up briefly to where we were. You know, I guess I'm in agreement with Representative Dabney and Representative Erickson both tonight. It's kind of a different world. I'm somewhat comforted by your remarks, but still, I'm worried about assumptions. My number one rule in teaching seventh graders was never assume they know anything. And it served me fairly well over the years. So we have to be careful about assuming that, you know, these are important standards for us.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members, on Article 2, Section 4, this reorganizes the benchmarks language. And also remove some language from prior year standards revision cycles. And it moves the academic standards expectations language from the benchmark section into the following section dealing with course credits. Section 5 of the bill, of Article 2, I should say, pairs the individual credit requirements that are required for graduation, pairs that language with their particular required academic standards. Again, you'll see the removing of the social studies content areas at the bottom of page 10, top of page 11. And then on subdivision 2, what we attempted to do here was consolidate all the credit equivalencies that exist out there for career and tech ed courses and ag science courses, and combine it all into one subdivision here so you kind of know where to go and what your equivalencies are going to be. Again, the purpose of these changes wasn't to modify what the existing legislation does. It's just to move things around and clarify it. I did speak with Ms. Larson prior to this hearing, and she had some language concerns here just to make sure that the credit equivalencies section didn't change anything that is current practice. So we may be working with her to get an amendment drawn up on this. As I understand, the bill will be coming back.
Yes, Mr. Cordy, that, excuse me, that's correct. And one of the areas of concern for me has to do with the career and technical education credit. I've had a conversation with Mr. Schoenfeld regarding this. Part of it, I think I understand what the department is trying to do here, and just in terms of moving language around, you know, so that there's a better fit here, there's a clear, you know, consistent, you know, reference. But you know, given the history, Representative Erickson knows this around career and technical education credits. It's vitally important that we, as we move language around here, that we don't do any damage to the intent of the legislature. And so we'll talk more about this, you know, when the bill comes back. Mr. Schoenfeld had shared a memo that Assistant Commissioner Chu had sent out clarifying, or rather articulating what the legislature clarified in statute. And so, you know, that could serve as a good template as we look at the new language to see whether or not this language order changes anything in that directive. But to be continued, we don't need to get fully into it here today. So I'm encouraged to hear that, you know, we're approaching carefully in terms of how do we order this language. Very well. Please continue, Mr. Cordy.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, that kind of moves us out of the educational expectations conversation for a second. Section 6 is a summary here. Section 6 expands the guidance that's given on gifted and talented assessments, programs, and procedures that would assist districts in serving gifted and talented students and would include groups traditionally underrepresented in the gifted and talented student population. And it would require districts to adopt guidelines for assessing and identifying gifted and talented students and procedures for early admission to kindergarten or first grade of those students.
Mr. Cordy, excuse me a second. Representative Sandra Erickson has.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cordy, you know, in light of the governor's proposal to roll in the gifted and talented, I find this most interesting that now we have a mandate, and yet his proposal is to roll those dollars in, which is going to make it difficult for districts, I think, to follow through with what our original intent was for gifted and talented students.
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, members, I think we do see those two proposals, this proposal and what's in the governor's budget bill, kind of working together. I think we do give districts some flexibility with how they want to spend those dollars, but we do want to ensure that districts are properly identifying gifted and talented students.
Very well. Please continue.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members, on Section 7, this is simply removing some obsolete language from the old basic skills tests that are no longer administered. Mm-hmm. On page 15, Section 8, this also is part of the educational expectations alignment that I discussed earlier. The language that's stricken at the page 15, lines 23 and 24, would be rendered obsolete under the changes that were made in Section 5. Section 9 is the charter school section. Bear with me as we walk through this because it's kind of, as you know, the charter school section is a long one. So starting on page 15, subdivision 1, this would require that all charter schools have as their primary purpose student academic achievement. This is something that is now going to be required by the federal government as a condition of receiving the Federal Charter School Programs Grant, of which we receive about $28.2 million. Moving on to page 17.25, I believe, is where the next change is. This is just a clarification that the applications that we're referring to here are charter school applications. On page 19, there's some language that's stricken that's just obsolete. The dates that are referred to in there was about authorizer transition. Those have already passed. On page 21.9 to 21.11, this strikes some language that is redundant with the language above it that you can see on 21.1 and 21.4. On page 21.22, this is a clarification that we're making. It just says if a charter school is going to hold a board election, they can't do it when the school is on break. We did have a couple situations where a school didn't say, well, we're not on holiday, we're not on vacation, we were on break. Just want to clarify that also you can't hold a charter school election during that time. On page 21.24, the change that's made there is just to clarify that a teacher that sits on the board has to actually be teaching at the school or be employed by the school. They need to be actually providing instruction if they're on contract. On page 21.31, there's some language that's stricken that is duplicative of the language above it in 21.30. On the next page, you'll see the next change at 22.11 strikes the word lease. The purpose of this is that leases and lease priorities are covered in subdivision 17, so by striking this language here, it just reduces confusion. On page 22.18, there is a mistake there that we would need to fix. The word grades should not be stricken on 22.18. So the purpose isn't to change the certification here. It's just that just to remove some duplicative language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Corte, I just question your use of the word breaks in statute. Perhaps there's a better way to word that. That would, you know, it's not a big deal, but I think putting breaks in statute is kind of the vernacular we use, but maybe not statutory language. Just a suggestion, and I'm happy that you've caught the error on 22.18, because that would not be good to place in statute.
Mr. Chair, members, continuing on, with the next change you'll see is in subdivision 4A on page 23 to lines 26 to 29. This is just some cleanup that shows that conflict of interest language regarding the charter school board member that is a teacher, that the conflict of interest wouldn't apply to that teacher, and also similar to the clarification earlier, just says that teacher needs to be an actual teacher who provides instruction at the school. Moving on to subdivision 6 on lines 24.7 to 24.8, or I should say 24.9, those changes are related to the primary purpose change that we discussed at the beginning of the section, which states that charter schools need to have student academic achievement as their primary purpose. And moving down the page there, on page on lines 24.18 to 24.21, it just states that the contract has to contain how the authorizer will comply with subdivision 15 and state and local, which has to do with review and comment, and state and local requirements. This is something that was just moved from clause 12, which you'll see stricken later on the next page. Page 25.5 to 25.7 is also has to do with the primary purpose that we discussed earlier. Page 25.15, you'll see in subdivision 6A, what this would require is that there would be some supplemental audit information that would be provided to the charter schools would be required to have, including on their parent companies or other administrative, financial or staffing entities that they work with, and then also on would include audited financial data of the affiliated building corporations or other component units that they might be working with. This is just a transparency item that we were looking to get added, and it kind of aligns with how audits work for traditional school districts. On page 26, I believe, you'll see the next change on line 26. This is simply a cross-reference to the audit requirement that we just discussed. On page 27.16 to 17, this aligns with what we discussed earlier about having charter school pupils subject to the truancy requirements in Chapter 268. On the bottom of page 27 on line 33, the purpose of this change is to ensure that if the school district does a lottery to determine how they accept pupils by lot, that that lottery process needs to be published on their website. On page 28.4, page 28, line 4, and down to point 1.2, what this does is similar to the truancy provisions. It just says that that charter school pupils are subject to the same compulsory attendance guidelines and provisions regarding early entrance that exist for traditional public school students. Next change you'll see is on page 29.14. This is just clarifies that boards are responsible for their actions. This doesn't increase any liability that they already have. They're already liable as board members under Minnesota nonprofit law. Moving down the page there onto subdivision 14, what this requires is that annual reports be posted on the website and then eliminates the requirement that those annual reports need to be submitted to the Commissioner of Education. On the next page is our next change on the top of page 30. This just clarifies what would be required for authorizer fees, what they can charge fees for. And then you'll see there's some language stricken on page 30.11 through 14. This is obsolete fee factor scale-up language that is no longer required. Moving down the page to 30.17, this just clarifies that a authorizer could charge a charter school pre-operational fees or pre-operational charges, but that's only after the school is chartered. You can't go back and charge fees for any pre-operational planning that was done before the school was chartered. On page 30.20, just requires that income be included on the submission to the commissioner relating to chartering activities. On page next change we see is on page 31, line 18. This just strikes the eligible to be an authorizer language here so that all school districts can will be eligible to lease to a charter school. On page 31.24, this clarifies that school districts must, or a charter school may organize a non-profit affiliated building corporation and submit an affidavit to expand an existing building. On the next page, or change, I believe, is on page 32.26, subdivision 17B. It's not new language there. We just take out the positive review and comment, move it into its own subdivision, and add a cross-reference to the previous subdivision just to highlight the importance of that particular clause. Moving on to 32.33, this just says that operators don't need to disseminate information on how to form an operator charter school. That's the job of authorizers and the job of the department. I believe the next next change you'll see is on page 34, lines 15 and 16. This is in regards to the primary purpose language, which we discussed earlier at the beginning of the section. Next change I believe you'll see is on page 36, line 9, and 36.11. What this just requires is that it removes a requirement that charter schools submit a copy of their insurance policy to the commissioner. Currently, we collect those. It's not really necessary for them to also submit them to us. If we do ever want to take a look at one, we can contact their authorizer who has those policies on hand. And, Mr. Chair, that wraps up the changes in Section 9 regarding charter schools.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Corte, in these changes to charter school law, you have met with charter school folks, I presume?
and then, or your staff has, and how many staff now are working in the charter school division?
Mr. Cordy.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I would ask Cindy Murphy, who is our charter school programs staff person that we brought here today, she may be able to answer those questions for you.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Cindy Murphy, and I am the Charter Center Director at the Minnesota Department of Education. Thank you for this opportunity. Specifically, to answer your question, Representative Erickson, we have four FTEs in the direct Charter Center right now, two charter specialists, an administrative assistant, and myself. We also work closely with individuals in other divisions. We have a grant specialist that works in our division of grants that helps us with the federal CSP grant project, as well as a charter compliance liaison that works in the department's monitoring and compliance division.
Representative Mr. Chair and Cindy,
I'm going to call you. I'm sorry, I forgot your last name.
Perfect.
Did you consult with anyone from the charter school partners or friends or those groups in regard to these changes? I don't see anyone here, so they must not have a concern, but have they been a part of these changes? I know some of them are just technical, and they're good changes, but...
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Erickson, yes, my office is in constant communication with our stakeholders, charter school resource organizations, authorizers, as well as charter schools themselves. While we didn't necessarily hold official meetings to present our bill, because that's not necessarily the way the process works from inside the agency when we submit Form A's. However, as I mentioned, we're in constant communication. Our partners are aware of the federal grant requirement that you see here represented as a policy change. Can't speak on their behalf as far as their reaction to it, but I think we're very much on the same page. While we may not agree on all points, that we have met with our stakeholders.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Murphy, for your work.
Representative Dapton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to either of the individuals at the table, looking at the changes you're on page 36 with the deletion of the requirement that charter schools provide insurance copies of their insurance coverage to the commissioner. If a charter school were to be sued and its insurance was found to be insufficient, in coverage, insufficient in the types of coverage it had, that sort of thing, who would bear the risk of that?
Ms. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the risk is solely on the charter school. But we've struck, or we've recommended that the language be struck here to simply delete the housekeeping, if you will, submission of the charter's information to the department. However, what we do when a charter contract comes in, a brand new charter or a renewal charter, our office reviews each charter contract for the required contract elements in law. And often, at that point, we look at the insurance information to make sure that it is consistent with the provisions that charter schools are held to. If it does not appear to provide that maximum coverage, we ask the authorizer to work with the school and to submit additional information or amended contract to our office. And so it's not that we have a complete absence of this information, but we really focus our review at the point of contract, contracting or renewal. As mentioned previously, if we needed to look at information or seek some additional information about a charter school, if a legal question came up, we would usually go first to the authorizer, as they're our key customer, if you will, with the contract, and if necessary, ask for additional information from the school.
Mr. Chair?
Yep, sorry, Dan.
Ms. Murphy, I appreciate the process. I understand it. It makes sense. But then on page 36, line 11, you're deleting the requirement that they submit changes. So at the time of authorization or reauthorization, they submit it, everything's fine, then they change it, and nobody has to tell you.
Ms.
Mr. Chair, we see the charter contract as the legal binding document between an authorizer and a charter school. And so while they have an obligation to share the contract as well as the terms of that with us when they enter into a new agreement, we leave it up to the authorizer to maintain the information that's part of the contract. In the past, we have not tracked this type of change. We don't have a summary of the charters that have changed their insurance carrier policy. We see that really as a local issue and something for the authorizer to definitely maintain, but not necessarily for the Department of Education to maintain.
Ms. Murphy, are there not, are there not state regulations relative to minimal requirements for the minimal standards requirements in insurance policy?
So the limits provided under statute chapter 466 are directly referenced in our charter law, and absolutely the charter school is required to meet that, the provisions and the maximum coverage amounts that are provided in that statute. However, again, this is simply indicating that a charter is not free from or away from any of those insurance requirements. They just no longer need to submit an updated policy or carrier provision to the department when they make that change with their authorizer.
Ms. Murphy, is that consistent with behavior expectations between regular district schools and the department?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak to that. I'm not sure.
Representative Abbott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the additional questions that you followed up with.
Representative Erickson, Roger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick questions. My district has no charter schools, so I'm just, how many charter schools are there? How many total students are we talking about here? Percentage of the total number of students that we serve, and maybe I'm getting on the weeds here, but are they? Is it a fast-growing type of thing? I mean, I'm just.
Ms. Murphy.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Erickson, I'll do my best. We currently have 146 charter LEAs, local education agencies, in our state, and those charters serve approximately 49,000 students, K-12. That represents just about 5% of Minnesota's K-12 public school enrollment for this year. We do have charter schools all over the state. They are authorized by 26 different charter authorizers. And we continue to see a growth in the number of students enrolled in charters. While the growth in the number of charter schools themselves has not necessarily been consistent, we actually have 11 new charter LEAs approved to open this fall. So we're definitely experiencing another growth spurt in the number of charter schools in Minnesota, and I think that can partially be attributed to the recent receipt of the federal grant Mr. Corte mentioned, where we're receiving about $28.2 million of federal support, largely to invest in the startup of brand new charter schools.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Corte, please continue.
Mr. Chair, so moving out of the world of charter schools, we're on to Section 10. What Section 10 does is allows a consortium of districts to apply together using a single application and evaluation process when applying to the commissioner for permission to enter into a flexible year, learning year program. However, each individual district would still be required to go through results, public hearings, and board approvals from each district. Moving on to Section 11. Sections 11, 12, and 13 also all kind of go together, and they're regarding revisions to the American Indian Education Act. These were changes that were requested of the department by the Tribal Nations Education Committee, and arose out of the American Indian Education Summit that Commissioner Casalius and the governor held last year. So you'll see in Section 11 what this requires is that the commissioner has to hold an annual field hearing to gather input from American Indian educators, parents, and students on the state of Indian education in Minnesota. This is based upon the summit which occurred last year, in which we found incredibly productive. Section 12 It requires consultation with the Tribal Nations Education Committee on the commissioner must seek consultation with that committee on all issues relating to American Indian education. Specifically, for those that don't know, the Tribal Nations Education Committee has each registered tribe has representatives that sit on that committee that are duly appointed. So it's a good kind of communications organization that we at MDE work with. We want to make sure that continues to occur. And then Section 13 would require the commissioner to keep employed an American Indian Education Director, and then it goes through kind of the qualifications and the duties of that person. We currently have one now. His name is Dennis Olson, and he was unable to make it here tonight. However, he's doing a fantastic job. We want to make sure that, as there's a transition, we continue to have an Indian Education Director at the Department of Education. Section 14 relates back to the alignment of educational expectations. This moves the schedule for standards revision outside of the benchmark statute where they currently reside to the required academic standards statute, and then has the revisor renumber all cross-references accordingly. Section 15 of Article 2 is a repeal of the old English language arts standards rules. These were rules that were in place from prior to when the Common Core ELA standards were adopted under the last standards review process. The old rules, for some reason, were never repealed, so this just repeals those old rules.
Mr. Cordy, this might have been asked when I stepped out, but currently, what determines the ongoing cycle of revisions for our state standards? I see we're striking language where we had, it's obsolete language, obviously it was set in time. But I'm puzzling over, so what happened, how do we determine the full set of the next cycle? Do we need to constantly proactively act to put dates in place? Is there somewhere in statute that says every X number of years, each one of these will be revised? Can you just share a little bit of light, if you could, for the committee on that? And then also kind of perhaps a tougher issue, and perhaps obviously related issue is what is the nexus of the authority or the executive branch to set the cycle of revisions for our standards?
Mr. Chair, I believe
Ms. Larson may be able to help here as well.
Sure. I believe right now that language exists in 120B.023. And you can see there, it's actually in this bill, that section is referred to, but on page 9, it says that academic standards relating to mathematics and related benchmarks will be reviewed in 15-16, arts in 16-17, and science 17-18, and then language arts in 18-19, and social studies again in 19-20. After that, I don't believe that there's a review cycle that's in law.
So it sort of begs the question, I suppose, about what happens. I guess I shouldn't worry about it since I'm not probably going to be here, but it sort of does beg the question about, it's inferred here that there is a regular cycle, that there is a logic in terms of years in between. We've had some debate on this in the past, and it's actually kind of enjoyed bipartisan support to lay out cycles that attempt to create less onerous fallouts for school districts, because there's constant adjustment that needs to happen. But on the other hand, I don't know that we've ever spoken about, aside from that, whether something else should guide the cycle of standards. And I don't, there's, you probably don't have a full answer for that. I just want to kind of lay this out for committee and for the executive branch to think about whether or not we might want to use a different logic, perhaps one that's connected to what happens on the ground practically to schools and school districts as they adjust curriculum, instruction, training, testing, et cetera.
Mr. Chair, I think that that's a great point. It's definitely something that we've had conversations about at MDE, particularly with kind of the advent and the movement toward Common Core standards. If you have these new standards that are coming out, particularly we were looking at the next generation science standards, which are being developed right now, you know, when those actually get published and start adopting them, we have this kind of lag in statute where even though the standards might be out and you know, that's they're kind of agreed upon, you know, we can't look at those, review those standards until the time frame that comes up in law exists. So that is something that we've been looking at, and it's something we'd be happy to continue to work with the legislature on, since obviously, you know, if these dates were to be changed, it would need statutory authority.
And Mr. Cordy, for members, new members, but currently we've adopted the Common Core in ELA, the English Language Arts, but have not done so in the Mathematics Common Core. And I believe those are the only two Common Core standards that have been developed or authorized, or I'm not sure what the right word is. But
that's correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, very well.
Article so moving on, I believe we had wrapped up Article 2. So Article 3, just kind of on a whole, is our technical changes to IDEA Part C, the Minnesota statutes that talk about the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act, which is federal law. There were new federal Part C regulations that were that have to deal with early intervention programs for infants and toddlers with disabilities that went into effect in September of 2011. States have until July 1st, 2013 to formally align their state statutes with the new regulatory provision. So that's what all these changes in Article 3 attempt to do. I will walk through those changes. Some are of more substance than others. In Section 1, what Section 1 does would include the Interagency Coordinating Council in a list of councils that would not, they wouldn't be subject to sunset anymore. Basically, the council would continue until federal law no longer required it. Sections 2 through 4 make minor wording changes that are just required for consistency purposes. Section 5 also refers back to the Interagency Coordinating Council. It aligns what the required membership of that council is to reasonably represent the population, and that the council chair cannot be a representative of the Department of Education. And then on page 42, there's also some requirements of what the ICC would be reporting. And again, on 42.8, 42.9, it would say that the ICC is no longer subject to sunset. Section 6 of Article 3 makes some federally required changes here, mainly wording changes that you see on page 42.27, strikes some old language and rewords it in the bottom, and creates a cross-reference to the new Code of Federal Regulations that were changed. Section 7 removes a requirement that the local early intervention committees review and comment on district total education, total special education systems, that is the TSES, and it makes some minor wording changes consistent with federal regulations. Section 8 adds a federal regulation citation to the definition of parent consistent with the new federal law, or do federal regs, and make some minor wording changes to accurately reflect how services are rendered. Section 9 makes some minor wording changes to be consistent with federal regulations. Also clarifies the what needs to be in the individual family service plans. Section 10 of Article 3 changes the citation to federal regulation. Make sure I'm getting that one right. Yep. So the change on 47.2, 2, and 2.3 reflects current practice, and then 47.25 updates a cross-reference to align with the new federal regs. Section 11, it strikes some language to align with current state practice. The new federal regs would state that we can't require parents to apply for certain other resources, particularly and medical assistance. And Section 12 is kind of a section that I guess stands on its own in the rest of these, in that it has to do with mediation procedure. So again, this is a change that would be required under federal law, under the federal regs, and just says that since mediation is a voluntary process, that and there's a time frame set out in law here, 30 days, that clock, that 30-day clock, doesn't start until the request for mediation is signed by both the parent and the district. And then it also states that the resolution of mediation is binding on the parties. I think we're working with the advocates on developing some better language here. The purpose isn't to make mediation itself binding, but rather that if the two parties reach an agreement, sign an agreement, that agreement is enforceable in the court of law.
I appreciate you working with the advocates on this. We've received a few phone calls on this
already. Right, yeah. Our intention was not to, as I said, make mediation binding or to turn this into more of an arbitration proceeding, but rather just that if that agreement is reached, that it's enforceable. Section 13 requests expedited rulemaking authority to make changes in the rules that are associated with these Part C statutes to align the rules with the new federal regulations. And Section 14...
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Cordy, that's to conform with the 2013 deadline. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. I believe the reason we asked for rulemaking authority is that A, to make that deadline, and B, because the changes weren't seen as being the changes would be made in rule wouldn't be seen as being particularly controversial, and wouldn't need the lengthy public hearing and comment requirements that go under the normal rulemaking procedure.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So, Mr. Corte, the advocates know that this is going to be expedited rulemaking, and will they be able to weigh in on this?
Mr. Cordy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, absolutely. I think that we would welcome any input that the advocates have. This language was sent out to, well, the advocates have reviewed it, and that's kind of how we found out about the issue in the language in the mediation procedure section. So they've definitely had a chance to look at this, and to my knowledge, they didn't have concerns with the rulemaking provision.
You.
And finally, Article 3, Section 14 is a repealer that repeals subdivisions 4 and 5 of that. It currently says that counties have to pay, and kind of under the current structure, that they don't pay anymore. So it's basically aligning with state practice, getting rid of some obsolete language. So that concludes Article 3. Moving on to Article 4. Which is only one section. This is a wording change that we asked the reviser to do in statute, just to clarify that when it refers to library development and services, we should now be talking about the division of state library services, just a technical change. That's it for Article 4. And Article 5 is just a clarification that we didn't. You can see that on page 50 on the top there, that early childhood scholarships aren't counted as earned income for purposes of medical assistance, Minnesota Care, MFIP, child care assistance, or Head Start. And Mr. Chair, with that concludes the agency's policy and technical bill. I'd be happy to stand for any more questions that members might have.
Thank you. We do have some amendments to the bill, or at least one. I'm not quite sure. There's an A1 amendment. Does anyone own that amendment? Perhaps not. No? Yeah. Well, it could be there's a member here who owns it who is not here. So members, are there any further questions? Is there anyone that wishes to testify in the audience on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
I'm kind of looking at the A1 amendment and kind of liking it.
kind of calls to you.
It does.
Can I get back to you on how much it calls to me? meanwhile, members, let me just say.
I'm speaking of phoning a friend. One just is showing up at the table right now. My apologies, Mr. Chair.
All right. Ms. Gilbert.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools. And this amendment is a result of, we had a bit of a communication error on our part when we communicated with the department.
I'm sorry, let's get the bill before us.
Oh, okay.
Or rather, the amendment properly.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment to be before the committee.
Moves the H115A1 amendment. Ms. Gilbert.
Again, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I apologize to the department because we had talked about some language that would straighten up the provision for the post-secondary enrollment option. Right now, under current law, a school district can bus kids to a post-secondary enrollment option under normal school routes and times as long as there's no cost to the district. And so the Irondale program, for example, if they decided to actually have a bus route that brought them to the college, that it's not permitted under current law. We have actually a group of kids that use a drafting lab at the St. Paul Technical College, and we do provide them transportation there. And so the language on the A1 amendment adds to the section of the policy bill that just says a school district may provide language if there's an articulated program, so that districts who have relationships with post-secondary institutions could actually provide the transportation if they have an arrangement like Irondale or us, and it would be, and it's totally optional, it's not required. It just gives them permission to do it. So that's the clarifying language on page one. And then the second part of the amendment is related to the highly mobile and homeless transportation. Under the McKinney-Vento Act, school districts are required to provide transportation to highly mobile and homeless students back to their school of record. Well, kindergarten kids don't have a school of record because they've never been in school before. And so this long amendment is just clarifying, and this is language that was recommended by the department. We had given them something different. If you go all the way to page 4 of the amendment, it says, for the purposes of this section, a district may provide transportation to a school-age sibling without a school of origin, so that would take care of the kindergarten student, of a homeless student transported if the siblings attend the same school. It's just really, frankly, common sense. If we're going to provide transportation to a homeless family, we want to keep the families together, again, whether they're in St. Paul or Minneapolis or in Hibbing. And so this is just clarifying language, and it doesn't have a fiscal note because the kids are obviously all in the same vehicle. So we've actually had families who have left the school because they didn't want to break the kindergarten student up from the rest of the family in staying in the school while they were in a homeless shelter. So this is not particular to St. Paul. It's just trying to clean up two sections that just make a lot of sense.
Well, Representative Biner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gilbert, would you help us again with this language here on page 4? I hear what you're saying, but I can't understand the language quite to be saying the same thing you're saying. So read through and see if we might not need some amendment to clarify.
Madam Chair and Representative Briner, so the school-age sibling without a school of origin would be the kindergarten student. We had another situation that arose where a student had applied to change schools and was accepted, right? And the other siblings had already attended that school, but for that particular sibling, that was not the sibling's school of origin, So that's why the language says that it's any sibling. We don't just delineate a kindergartner on that. And so they wouldn't necessarily, we don't have to always bus back to the old school as long as the rest of the siblings are at the new school. It's, again, just keeping them all in the same school.
So then is the next word in line four, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Ms. Gilbert, is it without a school of origin or a homeless student transported, or where, is that of?
No, it's for it's a homeless school that doesn't have a school of origin.
Okay.
Okay, because homeless, 99.9% of the kids have a school of origin. It's for the kindergarten kids who have never been to school.
Right.
Okay.
Just look at the connective. So, I'm sorry, Mr.
Well,
Chair. just look, it's the it's the language issue here. Is that? Am I just totally misreading this, or is the of supposed to be an or am I not understanding the issue
it's
at all?
It's supposed to be an if.
It's supposed
if
to be
a
an
homeless
if.
Student transmitted under
okay, that helps.
No.
Changes
no, no,
the whole
no, no.
Picture.
I, you know, Representative Briner.
I'm sorry.
How about if I check on that and make sure it's correct? I think the intent is to simply provide transportation to kindergarten kids if the rest of the family is going to the same school or a student.
Ms. Gilbert, it would seem to me that the correct word is if after the word origin.
No, I think it's right.
Ms. Larson? Mr. Chair, I just think it needs a rewrite.
Yes.
Mr. Chair? It is, I understand, confusing language. I guess I would ask that either we work on that now, if the Chair's indulgence would be for a clarifying oral amendment, or that we adopt the amendment and with a understanding that we'll work out the clarifying language. I think the intent is understood, even if the language is not.
I'll tell you what, Representative Dabney, why don't we, this bill is not, is going to sit here for a mm-hmm. few days. When we bring the bill back, why don't we do that at that time?
Sure. So I will, Mr. Chair, this time I'd like to withdraw the H1151A1 amendment.
Very well. Representative Dabney.
Thank you.
Withdraws the A1 amendment. And we'll come back to it. All right. And I see another member with the same number, but it looks like a Senate. Was this supposed to mirror? Well, we don't need to get into this. Is that? I'm confused. Is this a different amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney.
The last one spoke to me. This one's a Senate amendment. It doesn't speak to me at all.
I don't think it's speaking to anyone, Representative Dabney. Very well. Members, do we have the D2? Okay. All right. So here's what I'm going to do. We have a Chair's D2 amendment. I shared with members of the committee that we would be doing this, except I called it a DE1. But the intent of the Chair is to take, thank you, Mr. Cordy, the intent of the Chair is to take House File 1151 and use it as the core of our omnibus policy bill. And in order to do this in a way that makes life relatively easy or relatively less burdensome for our staff, and at the same time to be as fully transparent as we could be, what I want to do is share with you a big amendment that has everything that I think ought to be in it. However, I'm not going to move that amendment. The idea is just so you all have a look at it. We will then post a D3 amendment on Wednesday by the 24-hour rule that will work off that D2 amendment and will be based on what we do the rest of tonight and then all day tomorrow in terms of bills that are before us. So the idea here is to give every member an opportunity to then offer an amendment working off of this D2 amendment. which will put House File 1151 essentially in the form that the author wishes to have it before the committee. So then Thursday we'll be working off the deed to constructing the omnibus policy bill. I'm thinking we're going to continue that work into Friday morning. We'll meet our deadline, and then Representative Marquardt, you get this nice-looking bill for this committee in time for inclusion in your omnibus finance bill a few weeks from now. However, that D2 amendment is currently being copied, and so I can't share it with you right now. So we'll come back to it as soon as it's copied. We'll share it. Either way, we're going to lay House File 1151 over, and then we'll continue the rest of the agenda for today. Again, House File 1151 will come back off on Thursday to be amended by the D3 amendment and other amendments that you will be offering at that time. So with that, I'm going to lay 1151 over, and then we're going to get on with the agenda. Who's here? Oh, Representative Abler. Your timing is impeccable.
Yeah, too many of them.
Representative Abler, the chair moves House File 562 be recommended to pass, and I believe you need to go to the Committee on House Health and Human Services Policy.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, actually the language has already cleared policy, so if you can make the motion to finance, and if it has to go back, I will talk to the chair.
Very well. The chair moves House File 562 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance.
And there's a DE1, Mr. Chair.
And there is a DE1 amendment, and so I will move the DE1 amendment. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to be brief, this is, if you can see, it's a work in progress, which defines some of my work. And I almost didn't take the hearing, but I this is a fascinating topic because the challenge is how do we help kids in schools who are challenged? There's school-linked mental health grants. There's different outreach projects. I come from a district which has suffered 8 suicides in the last several years, which I find to be terrible. And so how 20 years ago we would not be so friendly and open about school-based counseling. In fact, I might have been here arguing against it. Times have changed, the world's changed, and we have kids who are very troubled, and it's not Mayberry anymore, if anybody even knows who Mayberry is anymore. And so there's some practitioners who are not covered straightforwardly on medical assistance that could be productive. In my research about this topic, you see a much shorter bill, now it's longer with more types of licensure listed. It's pretty much the same idea, and can we let these folks get paid in schools for doing some work to help our students? And the fact of the matter is that this is already virtually possible, at least almost. And so the reason I'm bringing the bill to you in a brief time tonight is just to point out that there are ways using community health clinics that you can have services in schools paid for by Medical Assistance in Minnesota Care, of which I was not aware prior to my work on this bill. And it's you have to kind of know the code, and it's kind of and so some districts, including mine, are not participating in this opportunity, and I bet a lot of districts don't know how to do that either. And the final version of this bill might say something about the department has to help schools figure this out, and so it might be a much more simple bill. I don't know that yet, but I'm just telling you the idea. And the bill, as it now requires money from medical assistants to pay for these services, straight up. But anyway, if that's tantalizing or interesting to you, it's fascinating to me. And trying to find a way to get more boots on the ground to help some of these kids have someplace safe to go talk to when they're feeling challenged. So with that, Ms. Abderholden has a few comments, and then I'll take questions.
Representative Abler, why don't we move to adapt your E1 amendment, since it's a delete everything amendment.
And Mr. Chair, let me explain the amendment.
Very well.
It was discussed briefly in the Health Policy Committee already, in the form that you had in front of you. The language that's in front of you was developed in association with the licensing board, psychology, BBHT, and social workers, and it's more inclusive than the original language. And it also ties it to school-length mental health grants, or mental health programs, which our holidays have to operate. So it, and just for your information, if you have a counselor, if you have a counselor, a social worker in a school, and the, and that student tells them about their mental health issues, as a, if they're a school employee, it becomes part of their permanent school record. If you have a contractor come into the school, now it's a part of the medical record and doesn't go up to college with them. So that's the amendment, Mr. Chair. So it'd be a good time to adopt it, and then we'll have testimony.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abler, I'm confused in line 1.8 of the DE1 amendment as to the clause who also meets the definition. Does that refer back to those individual licensed members who are of those boards, or is this supposed to refer to... I'm not sure. I'm just wondering if you need an and in there, and who meets. Is that your intent? And maybe Ms. Larson can help us, because as it reads, medical assistance covers those health services that are linked to this mental health program by an individual licensed, and then you have the boards listed, behavioral health and therapy, marriage and family therapy, board of psychology, or board of social work. And then you have that who meets the definition, and I'm...
Mr. Chairman, a phone a friend.
Do they have to be licensed and meet the definition of mental health practitioner? That's what I'm trying to discern.
Professor Abler.
I'd like to defer to my witness, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Holt.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, you have to do both because there are differences between a mental health professional and mental health practitioner, and you could still be licensed by the Board of Social Work, for example, and not meet either one.
So then, Mr. Chair, a question for counsel, Larson. The insertion of and there, would that then suffice?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members, on the H0562DE1 amendment to... create parallel construction and also make clear that there are two conditions that have to be met. It might be helpful on page 1, line 7, after individual, to insert who is, and on page 1, line 8, after the word comma, insert and. So it would be an individual who is licensed, etc., and who also meets.
Thank you. And then it's parallel. Thank you very much.
Ms. Chair, consider that. That's friendly, Mr. Chair. If you want to incorporate that, we would be happy for the help.
I will incorporate on line 1.7 after the word individual, the words who is, and then on line 1.8 after the comma, insert and. So I've incorporated that into my amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Are there further questions on the DE1 amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Ms. Afterholt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Afterholt in Nowy, Minnesota. We've been working with Representative Abler on this. We do want to encourage school districts that do not have a school-linked mental health grant to still collaborate with their local mental health center or mental health provider. We actually have several school districts around the state who do this, so I think this is another opportunity to really kind of raise the issue, and we'll continue to work with them as it moves its way through the process.
Wonderful. Are there any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Are there any other questions from committee members? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize this isn't finance, but do you think there'll be any, I mean, the cost will be picked up by services, or where will be cost, I guess?
Ms. Chair has written that there would be a medical assistance cost. There's no K-12 cost. It would be all on the health care side, which is why it's going to HHS finance.
Okay.
But it mentions it's engaged in the school, which is why it's here. So you understand, for marketing purposes, understand the value of this. Just for your own information and for the audience, my district needs some help moving forward with this, for instance. So trying to just help raise the news and also try to dent the demand, so thanks.
Okay. Just to share, my school district works with the mental health center. The mental health center in Crookston actually works for the whole district, all the way to the Canadian border. And so they bring in different types of mental health people to work with the school. There's actually somebody that resides in the school 2-3 days a week that works with, and I believe we do third-party billing in some cases. So, anyway, thank you.
Any further questions? Members, are we ready to vote? The Chair renews his motion that House File 562, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All in favor of that motion, say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Abel, and thank you for your creative processing. Very well. I believe, Representative Riddle, you've got a testifier that needs to scoot. So why don't we pull you up. Which bill is this?
984.
Also, all right, very well. Representative Erdahl moves the dot. Where's this one going? I vote this now. Okay. Representative Erdahl, I believe your motion is to, here it is. Your motion is to pass House File 984 and have that referred to the General Registry, or to the floor.
Well, I would actually prefer it laid over for possible inclusion.
Oh, very well. So Representative Erdahl moves House File 984 be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your indulgence for my testifiers. House File 984 simply adds one line to current statute. Parental complaints cannot be the sole reason for dismissing a coach. The purposes of this bill is to return focus away from parents to our student athletes. This may seem like a small thing to some, but it is a big problem for thousands of people in Minnesota. Another purpose is to empower school boards and administrators, freeing them from minor complaints and giving more power to our local boards. Parental complaints do remain part of the process regarding non-renewal of contracts, and it's an important part. It just can't be the only reason. Violations of laws or school policies are not changed with this. They still would have precedence. If a law was broken and a parent complained about it, that wouldn't count as a parental complaint in the sense that I'm addressing here. Bullying, is that a complaint against a coach? Well, about a week and a half ago, we passed a piece of legislation out of this committee by a vote, I think it was 11-9, that would address the bullying, if that is into statute. This does not change the at-will status of coaches. It does not change provisions regarding tenure. I did have a conversation at 12:30 this afternoon with David Stead of the State High School League and explained this bill to him, asked if he had any questions or objections. He said no, and then I said, then I will tell the committee this afternoon that you have no objections, and he said that is correct. High school sports are about learning life lessons. A recent survey of high school athletes rated winning as the 8th most important reason for participating in sports. A survey of coaches indicated parental complaints as the number one problem they face. Again, I don't want to minimize the role of parents. Their complaints should still be considered as part of the process, as I said earlier. But as time and monetary investments have grown in their student athletes, in some cases over the years, I think the problem has become greater. I believe that this is a common sense piece of legislation, as a school board member from Litchfield commented in the Litchfield paper over the weekend. I ask your consideration of this. I have with me Mike McMillan, the president of the State Hockey Association, and Mike Beck from the athletic directors. So, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, I'll go first. I'm Mike McMillan. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Hockey Coaches Association, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota State Coaches Association as well. State Coaches Association represents about 26 sports across the state of Minnesota and 8,200 coaches. In my role as executive director of the Hockey Coaches Association, I'm also the national coach in chief, which governs youth hockey across the country and represents about 56,000 youth coaches. So, pretty good base of understanding of what coaches are faced with today. In addition to that, I'm the director of the Probation and Parole Department in Wright County, and I know how important a positive structured environment is for kids and positive mentoring, something I do on a daily basis. Also today in the audience is Scott Mocco. He's a current head coach at South St. Paul High School and a former Rosemont head coach, and with him is Jim Baker, who's a 31-plus year head coach and 26-year athletic director in the public school system. So they're also with us today. A couple comments. Mr. Chair and committee members, coaches today are faced with unbelievable pressures, the likes that I've never seen in the 30 years I've been involved in coaching. The high school coach is an educational athletic coach. They're not a pay-to-play coach. Today's society is filled with AAA, AAU, JO. I can give you about another 15 terms that parents sign their kids up for to try to get them to the next level. But that's not what high school coaches are. I mean, they're educationally based, and they look out for the whole athlete. From an educational standpoint. And the other thing that's changed today is the customers become the parent, not the player. The coaches are faced with that as well. I believe the customer should be the player and have that relationship with their coach. 95% of the parents that we deal with are extremely supportive and they're positive, but we do have 1 to 2, okay, maybe 5%, that have gone too far, and I think coaches today need to be protected. This bill and our belief as a coaches association will also act to help administrators and school boards and give them more power, allowing them to make educationally sound decisions and not politically pressured, bullied decisions. And that's what coaches are faced with today on a daily basis. ADs, principals, and superintendents in dealing with parents are now stuck in some instances between the parent and the coach. And what I found in my role in dealing with coaches when they're faced in these situations is it really, for some of those individuals, it's easier to deal with the parents and just let the coach go. And that's, in my opinion, not correct. I think, and I've always believed, that parents and players should be given get feedback to the athletic department. I have no problem with it. I didn't as a coach, and it should be valued. But when it comes into strategy, play calling, and ice time or playing time on the field, that's where it should end. And the bottom line, when you get to the bottom line of all, most of these cases, it really becomes about playing time, in my experience. They'll use other things, but that's what it becomes about. So I think it'll help administrators and schools protect their coaches and work with them in a positive way. I agree with Representative Rudall, and it's a business that I work in, that I think we have laws and processes that we can deal with coaches that do unlawful wrongdoings or ethical violations. Already district policies cover that, and I'd be the last person that would support anyone who violates any of those to be coaching. Before I came down this past week, I was at the state high school tournament all week, and I had a lot of rubber chicken dinners that I had to attend in my role. But one of them that I attended at the very end was the Mr. Hockey Banquet, and it was interesting to listen to the elite athletes of our state of Minnesota talk about, at least in the sport of hockey, talk about their experience in high school sport. And one of the things that they all spoke to was coaches, how important and how influential those individuals were in their lives, and the special bond that they had with them and the mentoring that those coaches provided, and also how much love of the game and fun that they had. They didn't talk about winning. They didn't talk about getting to the next level. They didn't talk about where they're going to college. In their opening statements that they made to the 400 people that were there, those are the things that they talked about. And one of the striking things was when Grant Bessie stood up, who won the Mr. Hockey Award, he looked over to my left, and his coach was sitting there, Ken Pauley, and said how important he was in his life. And I don't know if all those players, matter of fact, one of them spoke that his sophomore year, he barely played. But because of the relationship he developed with his coach and the encouragement his coach gave him, Mike Taylor, he changed his whole game and became a Mr. Hockey candidate. And if he was not getting ice time, that was the whole premise of his conversation with the audience. But because he struck up that relationship with his coach and he stepped forward and didn't let his parents step in, he was able to achieve some pretty great things as an athlete. And I think that's what all coaches can do if they're given the opportunity. And I think this bill will help with that. The other thing is, I think it's a great life lesson that players and athletes learn how to deal with their coaches when they get out in the work world. I don't think, at least I hope not, that it comes to that, that their parents will be calling their college professors or their, without having the parents do it first. But that's just a little side note. My daughter's a college coach. She told me to say that one. So on behalf of all the 8,200 coaches that we represent, we're strongly in support of this sentence to be added to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. McMillan. Mr. Beck?
Yes, I am Mike Beck. I am the, how would I say, Executive Secretary of the Minnesota Interscholastic Athletic Administrators Association, commonly known as your ADs in the high school. And we do support this language. It is nothing that if, but a safeguard to the current coaches. If a parent comes to me, and I'll phrase my background here, I am retired from high school activities. I was the activities director for 26 plus years at St. Michael Albertville High School, taught for 34 years. I took advantage of the Rule of 90 and retired. I was a head coach for 27 of those years. I enjoyed it tremendously. But over the last number of years in my office, parents would call, and every parent calls has got a very valid concern, and they need to talk to somebody. But the crux of the problem was most of them didn't feel that their child was getting enough playing time, minutes, court appearances, and things like this. They wanted to be certain that they'd get more. And where the background of this comes from is all these Junior Olympics, AAU programs that we have, where a child is put on a team, the parent will spend out a lot more dollars than what they spend to support the school program. And they create a team for almost every level. And these kids get to play a lot. They get into the high school level. All of a sudden, you've got 9th, 10th, 11th graders all competing for the varsity spots. And the reason that they don't play is usually, according to the parents' opinion, and they get blinders at this time. It's because the coach doesn't appreciate real talent. Or the coach... It's all political. They're not playing. If they didn't appreciate real talent, we don't keep score then in the contest. We don't play to win. But most of those things were very good. You would sit and talk with the parent and understand that you want to talk to the coach. We'll set up a meeting. We'll talk to the coach. But in some instances, the parents feel the only recourse on the coach is to remove them because they don't really understand what's going on. Let's keep the parent complaints to where they belong as part of the process, not the sole process for removal or non-renewal of a coach. That's how we would feel the high school athletic administrators can support. It's part of our job to be very good at what we're doing and to realize what's going to happen here. And if we need to remove a coach, there's means to remove a coach. But just a parent not happy with the amount of playing time that their son or daughter is getting shouldn't be the sole reason. It could be part of the reason, but not the sole reason. So we really support Representative Erdahl's language item of the one sentence. I think is very good, and it may help schools simply say, "Hey, we'll talk about this, but this isn't the sole reason. If you want to have a conference, we'll talk to you, and we'll set up a meeting with the coaches and your child. But it's not the sole reason just to clean the house and find somebody else."
Very well. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me say that I know of voters who don't appreciate real talent.
They'll be incredibly impressed with this committee, right, members? Representative Faulks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl, for bringing this forward. I hope that this fixes the problem. I was the president of the Mora Hockey Association for about 12 years, and every year we had this issue come up, and they would write rules and say at this level, you know, you get this much playing time all the way up, and yet every year people would coming and complaining just about in every level because, you know, their kid is the next Olympic gold medal winner in their eyes, and I understand that, but the coaches didn't quite see it that way, I guess. And so I think that in high school, you know, we at least have control over that, and I hope that this helps this. I wish that we can actually do this actually for teachers as well. This was actually several years ago now when I was in high school, and this is kind of a scary story. There was one person in our class that was really struggling in biology. We had a multiple choice test, 40 questions, four possible answers for each, and he got two right out of 40. And his mother went to the school board and complained that the reason he was doing so poorly in science was he wasn't sitting close enough to somebody else to copy. And the biology teacher, I mean, our school was in the upper 90th percentile of schools across the country in science because of this teacher, and yet the year after I graduated, he left because of the pressure from this parent and others that he just said, it just isn't worth it, and quit. And so I think this is a great, I hope it does what you're hoping to. I just wish that we could expand it to other areas as well, but thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Breiner, Representative Erickson-Steinberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Ertl, I don't know exactly how to ask this question, but what I want to, I guess I want to ask you, have you spoken to any school board members about this?
Representative Ertl.
Thank you, Representative Breiner. Yes, I have. Last night, I had a fairly long conversation with a local school board member, and I've talked to other school board members as well. In essence, you know, basically they understand that this changes the focus a little bit, but no matter what the complaints are from parents, if they feel that they need to get rid of a coach, they will have a reason for getting rid of the coach that's other than parental complaints.
Mr. Chair, well, I guess what I want to speak to, not to echo Representative Grünhagen too much, but I was a school board member for a number of years, as we're often reminded of from Representative Grünhagen. But anyway, my point is that board members have a responsibility for due process in all situations, and we receive pressure. Board members receive pressure from parents on a range of issues, a wide range of issues. Coaches may be the one that maybe has the most public notice, but I certainly over the years received a wide range of pressure from parents on school-related issues, leadership in school buildings, curriculum issues, and all those issues. My responsibility as a board member was to go to the process. Who is it that you need to talk to about this issue? What is the rule? What is the procedure? And to refer them to that process and not to allow the pressure to move me to a decision. So that's my concern here. What's the uniqueness of this circumstance over any other responsibility an elected official has to follow procedure?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Breiner. I actually think that Mr. Beck can address that because I think in a lot of school districts, the AD is the key part of the process. A complaint comes to a school board member from a parent. I do believe in most areas, I know it is in Litchfield, that it would then be passed on to the athletic director. And so I think I'm interested then in how Mr. Beck would respond to that.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your foresightness as a board member. That when we got the complaints, it is for an activity as athletic administrator, you investigate. You call up the parent and say, let's talk. What's the issue? And then you get down to it, and sometimes you spend 20, 30 minutes on the phone with them or in person to your office, and you realize, let's just say, do you feel comfortable talking with the coach? No. Do you feel comfortable talking to the coach with somebody else in a room such as myself? Let's do it. But don't make it the sole crux of somebody calling. It just, if somebody calls with a complaint and you can figure it out if it's playing time, if they say, well, they're doing this to the kids in practice and this to the kids in the game, that's a whole different reason. But just a complaint basically that they're not getting my child a fair shake, you'll take it, you'll investigate and talk about it, but it stays there.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to belabor the point, but I guess my position is that a board member has a general responsibility not to micromanage, period. you know, and this is just one example of micromanaging, and if you're living up to your responsibilities as a board member, you aren't in this decision on the basis of the parent complaint.
Mr. Chairman? Well, exactly, Representative Brainard. If you get the complaint, if a school board member gets the complaint, they are normally going to go up the process and convey that to the athletic director, and then it will go on from there. I think Mr. McMillan had a comment on this, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brainard, I think this helps you exactly do what you want to protect yourself and other board members for. So when they get that phone call, you can easily refer to it and say, thank you. You know, we'll address it with the athletic department or principals, superintendent, whoever. But it'll allow that superintendent or the school board members, I believe, to say, you know, one of the things that we will not do is just remove coaches on parental complaints. So I think it actually helps and strengthens the position of the board members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, members and Representative Verdahl, this refers only to head varsity coaches. The statute only refers to them. That's it. Secondly, gentlemen, Mr. McMillan and Mr. Beck, the phrase existence of parent complaints is this wide and this deep. Do you realize that perhaps if parents complain about the incompetence of a head varsity coach, they would not be listened to? I mean, that's a legitimate complaint. So, you know, I'm concerned about the broadness and the vagueness of the phrase existence of parent complaints. And furthermore, this refers only to head varsity coaches. So, you know, I think you might, Representative Erdahl, want to reconsider some of your intent here, because this would only refer to head varsity coaches. That's the way I'm reading the statute anyway, subdivision 3 of section 1 of 122A33. I think I'm correct in that.
So that's how I read the statute.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative.
The statute originally was one that I proposed. The one that this is being amended to is, again, my original statute, and you are correct in that. I would like to have Ms. Larson go into the definition of existence here.
Oh, boy. That sounds existential.
I know. I was going to say that, too, but I...
well, Ms. Larson...
To explain that reference that Representative Erickson had.
Well, no, Mr. Chair, my concern is about complaints. I think that's my mile wide and a mile deep. That's what concerns me, is the existence of parent complaints. So parents complain about the incompetence of a head varsity coach. Do they not have a legitimate argument to present to a school board, who then can notify the head varsity coach within 14 days that, you know, they might not renew his contract or her contract? I'm just concerned about the vagueness and what complaints can encompass. Thank you.
Ms. Chairman.
I'm not hearing Representative Erickson proposing violence to the language, but there's some, I think,
okay.
Good advice for you to think about in terms of the language.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erickson, I did confer a little bit with Ms. Larson about this, and I think I can answer in that. The word existence just means that there is a complaint there. It doesn't deal at all with the substance of the complaint. And I think that that's, you know, an important distinction. The substance of the complaint could be one that violates state law or violates a school policy. So we're dealing with the substance, and in some ways it needs to be a little bit vague. But the existence of a complaint is one thing. What it's about is another.
Representative Marquardt has a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl, for bringing this forward. You know, I think a lot of this has to do, and when I've talked to athletic directors and that, is giving the situation time and space. You know, you can look at this abstract, just words, but in practical, I know at the basketball games and the football games in my community, there might be every school board member in attendance at the game right with the parents. And, you know, I mean, it's so it's a very, I mean, it's just so connected. And I think what, you know, whether or not this, I mean, if a school board wants to get rid of a coach, they can come up with all sorts of reasons. I think this does kind of provide the time and the space, and just saying that, and even some cover for a school board member, that it just cannot be a parent's complaint. And they have to look at other things, which I think probably all school boards would, but sometimes just putting something in language in a bill kind of can send a message and, again, provide hopefully this time and space to separate from the issue, because we know how, especially with tournament time right now, how intense things can be made when, you know, I remember a head basketball coach at the school where I teach at, after their team had lost the game very closely and had missed at the free throw line, asked the coach if his team practiced free throws during their practices. And, I mean, you know, this is the type of thing you get. He said sarcastically, no, of course they don't practice, but of course they did, but it was fun listening to him tell the story. But it is, and as our testifiers mentioned, I haven't been coaching for 13 years now since I got in the legislature, but times have changed. I mean, you have parents investing a lot of money and a lot of time into these traveling teams, JO or whatever you want to call them, and it's different than it was 20, 25 years ago, where your schools were your only basis of sports and that, and you had the coaches through the school, and now the parents pay these coaches, they pay for their uniforms, they will direct the coach in many cases on these traveling teams, what they're going to do and so forth, and there's a different culture than there was probably 20 years ago. So I think, I mean, I think this is the right way to move. I don't think there's any damage to doing something like this, and actually may provide some good.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony here.
Thank you.
My son just lost his sectional game this Saturday, so
hire the coach.
And he's we're gonna fire the coach. Actually, we love our coach. He's a good presence in my son's life. So thank you for the work that you do in helping our young people grow up to be good adults. Mr. Schneidwin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Kirk Schneidwin. I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I have a great deal of respect for Representative Verdahl and know his coaching prowess and the beauty of, as a former high school golf coach, a basketball coach myself, I know that when you deal with golf and track or golf and cross country, the numbers don't lie. I mean, you can pretty much determine how the process is going to work. But I think one of the things that's important to understand is that school board members, when they're elected, understand that they're going to have tough decisions before them. There's no question about it. And I think Representative Breinert talked about the importance of boards being the governing body of the school district, and they aren't the administrators. And they function through policy. They establish the procedures for the ADs and the principals and the superintendents to do the investigations. So when it ultimately gets to the board, there's been some fact-finding, information's been collected, and the board then can make an informed decision. If the data or the requirements aren't thorough enough, the board will ask for more. And I think that's the duty and responsibility of the board. There's already a method that currently exists in law for the, as it's shown here in the statute that's being amended, for the coach to address his or her concerns or reasons for non-renewal. I think that's an important thing to remember as well. And I think one of the things as a school board member, one of the things as a representative of school board, is we encourage parent participation. I think it's very important for the parents to be involved in the process. And I think you even see school districts before athletic programs begin, is they require all their coaches to have parental meetings before the season starts. So the coaches can get out and lay the ground rules, lay out the expectations, and make sure that they understand what the expectations are, and the parents are a part of that. Now, there's not a requirement that the parent has to attend, but I think it's important that they try to preempt that and get out front and talk about those issues on the forefront. So I think the issue that we're concerned about mostly is the fact that the number of complaints. I mean, it could be one complaint or two parental complaints or 35 parental complaints. And the board could say, well, these are legitimate issues, but I can't dismiss or non-renew a teacher based on this, but I could dismiss the coach for the fact that he didn't qualify for the state tournament or wasn't successful in the section tournament. So I think there's a lot of questions, and this is a lot of questions and concerns that we have, and I think it's also important to understand that when you're looking at, you know, a mid-sized metropolitan district, you're talking about 1,800 coaches. I mean, that is a number of coaches that not boards, but administrators will have to evaluate. And I think if one thing this does highlight is the importance for ADs and head coaches to evaluate their junior high, freshman, sophomore coaches as well, to find out if they're meeting the needs and demands of the parents and the community as well. And so we certainly think that there's a process in place now that allows the coach to address these issues, and our boards aren't looking for cover. I mean, we want to deal with the issues up front. We want to deal with the facts, and I think that's an important piece to consider. Be ready for any questions, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Mr. Schneiderwin? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else who wishes to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond very briefly to Mr. Schreinemann's comments. Hey, I agree with almost everything he said. But the fact is that this is not going to dramatically affect any of his objections. It basically just says that a parental complaint shall not be the only reason for dismissing a coach. And if there are 35 reasons, complaints from parents about a coach, they'll still be able to dismiss that coach. I don't know of any coach has ever been dismissed, maybe some of you remember, where the reason given was parental complaints. That's not a reason that's given. If they want to dismiss a coach, they'll dismiss a coach. I'm just saying, let's move the focus away from parents back to student-athlete where it belongs, and give them just a little bit of comfort, and I still believe a little bit of freedom to the school boards and how they operate. With that, I'd appreciate your support.
Very well. Senator Verdal, your motion is to lay over for possible inclusion. Is that correct? Very well. So this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the policy omnibus bill. Thank you. Representative Seltzer. I apologize for having you wait. You're not a member of the committee. I was hoping to get to you sooner, but we had some testifiers in the room that we wanted to make sure on the previous bill had an opportunity to testify. So, Representative Seltzer, I'm going to move House File 354 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. Your bill is before us.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, teachers are not and should not expected to be experts in detecting mental health issues, but they are, along with parents and guardians, in the front lines of observing and understanding the children they come in contact with. Many times, referrals from teachers to appropriate professionals have made all the difference, in children's lives. Under current law, teachers must receive continuing education about understanding the key warning signs of early onset mental illness in children and adolescents as part of their relicensure. This was passed back in 2003. Many teachers who have taken the initial continuing education about the early warning signs of mental illnesses in children like to learn more about other topics related to children's mental health. This bill would give them that option, but would not force teachers to do anything they are not already required to do. So this bill would clarify that teachers who have taken an initial course about understanding early warning signs may, during subsequent licensure renewal periods,
take courses that provide a more in-depth understanding of children's mental illnesses. Some possible topics for this more in-depth in training could include trauma, accommodations for student mental illness, parents' role in addressing student mental illness, fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, autism, Minnesota's laws governing the use of seclusion and restraints in schools, and other mental health related topics. Those courses would then count towards their continuing education requirements. And I do, I could stand for questions, Mr. Chair, or would you like to have Ms. Abderholden testify first?
Why don't we hear from your testifier, Ms. Abderholden.
Great, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden from NAMI, Minnesota. This is one of the 12 children's mental health bills that we are looking at this session. You know, this law was passed in 2003, went into effect in 2005. It was a bipartisan bill. Representative Segrin and Representative Greiling were the co-authors on it. Everyone agreed that this was a really good idea. Even if you looked at the schooling to mental health data, we had a large percentage of general education teachers who were actually referring children to the mental health services, so I think that's a very nice kind of connection. And all we wanted to do was to make sure, again, that once teachers had that kind of initial course, and actually you might, for those of you who were around back then, NAMI actually promised to deliver it for free to any school that asked, and so we've actually done it for free to thousands of teachers in the last, you know, 7 years. And you can actually see, as you're providing the information, you see the little light bulbs going off in people's heads when they're like, oh, this isn't a, you know, willful behavior. Oh, I could do this to really help the child succeed. But there are more topics now, especially related to trauma. Some of you might have seen the ACE study in terms of the adverse childhood experiences, and so dealing with kids who've gone through trauma is a whole other issue. So we just, again, want to make sure that if they take these other courses that are a little bit more in-depth, that that will actually apply to their relicensure. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Irvin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Abderholden, will you be willing through NAMI to provide some of this more in-depth training dealing with trauma, mental illness? Because I know you have really some really good presentations that could help. But, you know, I think teachers need to know that someone's going to make this available to them so that it's not an extra cost to them as they renew their licenses. And that they're going to get experts in the field to help them. So is that a commitment from you again? As I know you committed in 2003 to Representative Mariani and me. I think we're the only two who are here then.
Madam Chair, or Mr. now you can see I've been through too many hearings today, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erickson, absolutely. And we also, it's good to remember, too, that we have the AMBIT Network in Minnesota, which is part of the National Traumatic Child Network, and they provide training for free as well. MACMA, the Minnesota Association of Children's Mental Health, does it well. So this won't require them to take anything beyond, but if they want to, again, it could. And we always, you know, I think almost everything except our state conference is provided for free.
Representative
Slotsky. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As one of those teachers that need relicensing every 5 years, but I am on a planning committee to help set up for teachers every year too, and we provide look for people who are willing to give a MI presentation. And I think that this does help a little bit because I think different school districts take that requirement very seriously in very many different ways. Some of the committees that approve these relicensing classes are very strict and very narrow-minded and very like, nope, this is the way it's got to be, and it's only by this kind of licensed person versus somebody else who is very good in that field who might be a social worker. We've had many different people present from who help with mental illness in the community to our social workers to but I'm also very happy to hear that you are willing to come out, and I feel bad that we haven't heard that you are willing to come out to our district. So I would invite somehow that invitation to be sent out, because it's nice to get all kinds of perspectives. But certainly we all know that this is going to open the door for more and better topics to be discussed. So I appreciate that.
You know, and I was looking at the language on 3.17, and Representative Erickson is not in the room right now, but obviously we're using permissive language, may include upon the renewal. And I was thinking, well, why is it permissive? I think perhaps one of the reasons is because of the potential extra costs to teachers. But Ms. Abner-Holden, can you say a little bit more about why the first part would be a requirement, and then this more prescriptive, if you will, it's not quite the right word. More prescriptive set of knowledge. Why that might be permissive knowledge relative to the license.
Mr. Chairman, you'll note that on 3.14 is where we do require licensed teachers to actually get at least the early warning signs, and the Board of Teaching came out with some topics that can be part of the key warning signs, and this just goes beyond that. So I guess I don't really know why it should be must or may, but at least we know that teachers have to get the training, but now they have a variety of topics that they could choose from.
Well, is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Are there any further questions from committee members? All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Abner-Holden, and Representative Seltzer, House File 354 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members. Thank you for your patience. Members, we have Representative Erickson. Roger, are you good to go? Very good. Representative Erickson. House File 1067. And Representative Erickson, I believe you have a motion for us.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House 1067 for movement to the House and also into the omnibus bill.
Very well. Representative Erickson, the motion will be to pass House File 1067 to the floor.
Yes.
Obviously, later on, we can always amend this language onto a policy bill as well.
Okay.
That would be your desire to do so.
Sure.
At that point. So Representative Erickson, R moves passage of House File 1067 referred to the floor. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this does is basically brings the conveyance of the right title and interests back to the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians. It's just a transfer of, I look at it more of a housekeeping thing. You must understand that the land up in Red Lake is an extremely precious thing, and just for them to have the title of it would be very important for them. Nothing else changes. They're not trying to get involved in the school. The lease is probably still going to be the lease. I don't think really a lot's going to change, except it probably clears up an issue for them.
Very well. Are there any? Do you have any testifiers?
No, I do not.
Okay. Are there questions from members? Representative Erickson, Sandra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, why does the tribe need this transfer? And maybe I should ask first, who owns the land on which the school district exists, and why would they need the transfer? Because I would think they would own the land.
At this particular time, what I'm thinking is happening up there is they want the title in their own name. Right now it's probably under the Red Lake School District's name. And so I'm thinking they're just cleaning up that wording.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ennis.
Thank you. That could be. I know that Red Lake is the only federally recognized Indian tribe that does have a state school district, so perhaps that's true. But there are mineral rights on that land, so who is going to own those mineral rights?
I believe it's listed in there that, excuse me. Or Chairman Mariani, the mineral rights I believe will be going back with the tribe.
This is very confusing, and it always is when we have these kinds of transfers going on. I think they're rare for Indian tribes to do, but it seems to me if the mineral rights are now with the school district, that's an asset to them, and particularly because, you know, we provide for most everything for the Red Lake School District in that there's no tax base. So I find that rather interesting that the mineral rights would be transferred as well, considering the fact that perhaps there's something there that could help the school district. But I don't know if you know the answers to any of that, and I wasn't able to find any answers before committee, so.
Representative Erickson, my guess, well, first of all, you're not going to tax that land anyway because it's the school district property. I think there's, in the entire reservation, there's one small piece of land that was like an old railway right-of-way, and that's the only piece of property up there that is not listed in the tribal name. And so my guess is that when they wanted this bill, that they wanted just to kind of clean that up.
So, Mr. Chair, and the school district has agreed to this?
Yes.
Since it's one of our public school districts, thank you.
That's okay. Thank you, and thank you, Representative. Just a history. When was it switched? Was it switched back? I'm just trying to understand how did it initially get out of the hands of the tribe.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani, Representative Kresha. That's a good question. And the puzzling thing about this to me is that they ever let it out of their control before. And I don't know the history of when.
Thanks. Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Erickson, or Representative Erickson, I'm not sure if this might have been the land on which the boarding school sat way back in the 1930s, I believe it was, 30s and because this Red Lake did not become a school district until later, but it might have been the land on which the U.S. government had the boarding school. But we could do some research on that, I guess, if we needed. But that might be the situation. It might have been the acreage that was set aside because Red Lake had a boarding school.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that if you look at the bill on 2.1 to 2.3, it says that the United States, reserving, however, to the United States all mineral deposits. So that's on the first and third piece of property. And the second one, it says there are reserved to the United States in trust for the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians. So it looks to me like two of them, the mineral rights are being reserved by the United States, and the third one is by a trust, United States in trust for the Red Lake Band of Chippewa. So, so I think that that's the answer to the mineral rights.
Are there any further questions? Anyone else wishing to testify on the bill? Well, then, if not, Representative Erickson renews his motion that House File 1067 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register on the floor. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Erdahl.
Part 2.
House File 734. Senator Verdahl moves House File 734 be recommended to pass, and I believe your referral is to the Committee on Government Operations.
Yeah.
Very well. Your bill is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and you know, this really is a simple little bill. because last week we talked about something, a provision of Representative Brainerd's bill that does have some elements of this. You recall that I did an amendment to change her title to Pathways and Technical Education. A reason for that was to raise the focus onto vocational technical education. And we are, I believe, channeling most of our students to four-year academic institutions. Our high schools, vocational education departments are being trimmed back or outright cut. The result is a skills gap and the needs of some students and the job market are not being met. An insufficient supply of skilled workers contributes to hiring difficulties in 2 out of 5 state job vacancies in nursing, engineering, and production, according to DEED. I'm seeking ways to find more collaboration and concurrent education between our high schools and two-year technical institutions. I believe there are models to explore. I went to Anoka Hennepin last year and examined their program. On a worldwide scale, Finland is very successful in this endeavor. I'm asking that we form a task force to seek the best ways of making this work in Minnesota. Representative Brainerd is on the right track, but not in this room. There may be elements of this bill. I'll start over with that one. Representative Brainerd is on the right track.
But you prefer.
There may be elements of this bill that should move on alone or be combined with theirs. I'm just asking that this be sent on to government operations so that various avenues can be explored as to the fostering of vocational education in our high schools. That's all it is.
Okay, well, there are questions. I'm going to start with Representative Brainerd, and then we have Representative Bly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, I'm sorry that I missed your initial opening, so I apologize for that. What I would ask you is, would you be open to considering how we might actually combine these task forces at some point? Because the concern I have is that we would have two very similar tasks. I mean, maybe almost identical membership doing somewhat different tasks. And I do think that that's, you know, in the interests of efficiencies and economies of scale and so forth. I'd be open to doing that.
Ms. Chairman, Representative Brainerd, I'm certainly open to doing that, too. All I'm trying to do is to send this up the road a little bit, and if it's combined or, you know, well, that would be fine. All I'm looking at is to heighten the focus on vocational technical education.
Very well. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Erdahl, I support your effort here. This is something that I was very interested in several years ago and was trying to pull together people to talk about this very thing. I'm wondering if in your task force you might consider looking at including some of the trades and carpenters or others that sometimes do have education programs too that aren't necessarily included in the mix. They may have some advice or some comments to make about this.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Bly, I'm very egalitarian in who's in the task force. You know, when we put this together originally, there were a lot of additions and subtractions. And if we can come up with a group that should be involved, I'm all for that.
Thank you.
Representative Roger Ferris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I applaud this. I wish I had been smart enough to think of it myself. Up in going through my district and talking to the superintendents up there, there's a couple of them that are actually building houses to be sold. One of them was actually already sold for their
high school principal actually was buying it to set it up on his place. They're already doing some very good things, but yeah, I'm all about this. I like it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, the discussion we had in committee on Friday about moving assessment to college and career readiness, the career readiness piece, and the different approaches to meeting benchmarks and remediation is exactly intended to include things like building houses as a way of demonstrating proficiency. So, you know, I think we're on the same track exactly in terms of our vision of different ways in which students can show their skills. People learn differently and they demonstrate proficiency differently.
Just through a little history, many of you have heard of John Dewey, the great reform education reformer. In the beginning of the last century, his mantra was learn by doing. Boy, we've come a long way in 100 years.
Life is a cycle. Representative Aronson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bly and Representative Erdahl, I think Clause D on 2.9 and that entire paragraph for Clause D, and then the statement in your task force or our task force that other representatives can be selected by the task force members may fulfill Representative Wise, I think, very important recommendation that the trades be included. So if this goes forth and Representative Briner and Representative Erdahl, you merge this, you might want to insert some language that would address that more specifically. But I think we have a part of it in Clause D and then a mention of other task force members in your task force membership.
Thank you.
On lines 3.6.
But to point out the committee's intent in terms of being inclusive in this way. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Very well. No further questions? If not, Representative Erdahl renews his motion that House File 734 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Government Ops. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Erdahl. Members, thank you. Congratulations. I'm very anxious to go home and get some rest myself. We did lay House File 1151 over. As I explained earlier, that will serve as the vehicle for us to shape up together an omnibus policy bill. There is the D2 amendment fresh off the presses. I think it's burning Emily's hands as she holds it up. So why don't we distribute that? Wonderful. And there's a summary along with it, so you don't have to read. I've been doing page by page all weekend through this as we're working on this. So, members, again, the intent here is to give you early, view of how the chair wants to move with the shaping the omnibus policy bill. We will bring in. I will post the D3 amendment by Wednesday. That we will then be working off of. This will be the guts of it. It'll reflect the actions that we have taken here today and the ones that we'll take tomorrow in the morning and in the evening. And then members will all have our crack at it in terms of amending things out or amending things in or just plain old amending. So I hope it's helpful in terms of providing some guidance of the parameters, if you will, of the omnibus policy bill. And I know that we've had a couple of instances the past few weeks where one amendment has kind of reshaped, the ability of other members to be able to amend. I will work to be as creative and flexible as possible to make sure that all your amendments will have their ability to be considered in the committee.
Representative Eretz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And will we be then drafting our amendments to fit the DE3 or the DE2?
Does that work? Yeah. All right. So we're going to have to print it out. Okay. All right. I want to make sure I get the right answer here because this is, you know, the logistics here are kind of a little mind-boggling. So your amendments will be shaped to the DE3 amendment. That will be posted by Wednesday, 24 hours. So Wednesday morning, maybe Tuesday night even. If we can get it out early. You will all have until Wednesday, 6 p.m. to be able to get your amendments, because that makes sense. Otherwise, we won't have a look at the DE3 until it's too late to amend. If you run into snags with that, let me know. I will work in flexible with you all. The intention here is to make sure that your amendments are fully considered, but at the same time, I want to make sure that we're not keeping our staff and other folks here 24 hours a day, trying to get very last second amendments drafted. Representative Ernston, is that clear?
I think so, Mr. Chair. We also do not want to overwork staff, so we'll take a look at it as soon as it's released, the DE3, that is.
Very well. In the meantime, look at the DE2. It gives you an opportunity then to see what the DE3 most likely will look like. And obviously keep track of what we're doing here in committee. It'd be my intention to honor the work of the committee here insofar as we're pulling in bills that we've laid over for consideration in the DE3 amendment. Any further questions? All right, so we're back tomorrow. We'll meet at our regular time in the basement, and then we will meet in the afternoon after session. Oh, 6 p.m.? 6 p.m. in room 5, so we'll have a comfortable room to continue our work. All right, very well. Have an enjoyable evening. We'll see you all in the morning. Committee stands adjourned. Yeah.